Thank you for joining us today at the Thai Podcast. Welcome to the show.
Then I remember what I became most interested in were golf courses at a very early age, when we'd go to the class in you know, elementary school, to the library. Like, I would go to the sports section, see if I could find books about golf courses, like with pictures, big color pictures. And I've said this before, like on my podcast, that's what really hooked me. We want to preserve that continuity, but it's just about making sure that we have the right systems of knowledge to be able to effectively build an evaluation that's going to add value. But it's really, really hard to get into the top echelon. And once you get there, it's also typically hard with their evaluation numbers to dislodge them.
Yeah, absolutely. What are some of the podcasts you gravitate towards that are not golf related?
I recently stumbled upon Bill Simmons, you know, the Ringer. Mm-hmm. He has this whole line of podcasts where he interviews. A lot of them are athletes, but they're just long interviews with a lot of them are movie based. He's got they do movie reviews and things like that as well. So I've been going back into the archive and listening to these ones with, I don't know, Matt Damon or Michael Keaton, or just these actors and other celebrities that are just fascinating. You know, you get these guys, they're not necessarily on press junkets. They're just talking about, and he'll get like these Ben Affleck talking about Boston sports. You know, it's kind of interesting just to, and they're very relaxed, casual conversations, which I appreciate. So that's one if I need to fill up some time, I've got a lot of those I can go to, and then everyone has been really interesting.
Yeah. Cool. Well, let's go ahead and jump straight into the dirt before we get deeper into the golf conversation. So Derek, what have you been drinking, eating, reading, and thinking lately?
Drinking is pretty constant. I'm a bourbon guy. I gravitate toward the old distilleries of the Louisville area. There are five or six distilleries that have been making bourbons for a long time, Buffalo Trace, Heaven Hill, Brown Foreman, you know, things like that. So those products that are staples in the bourbon world are what I go to. There's 80% of what you see on shelves are upstart distillery. They're not even distilleries, upstart labels that purchase their bourbon from other places. There's a big distillery in Indiana that makes most of it, and they'll sell it. And you can specify, they can specify kind of like what kind of characteristics or mash bills that they want. And then they might send the bourbon to these smaller producers or bottlers, really, and they can age it in their own barrels and things. But I find that there's a lot of inconsistency in that, and they're not always upfront about where the bourbon comes from. So I kind of stick with the Wild Turkey stuff, Four Roses, Maker's Mark. Bourbon proof is really good. A nice aged bottle of Elijah Craig, if you can find it. You know, just that kind of thing. Just those old standbys. So that's my cupboard is usually pretty stocked with bourbon.
Yeah, I took a quick look at your Instagram a couple days ago, and I figured bourbon was probably the answer that you would give. Yeah. A lot of good content on there. I'm trying to learn more about bourbon myself, but I am a complete and utter novice, without a doubt.
Do you sip on bourbon sometimes, or?
I do, but please don't ask me what I like or what
what's your drink. If you get this question, what do you say?
So when I get this question, I'm not a huge drinker myself. Just alcohol and drink. I drink, you know, time a week, a couple times a month, whatever it is. But typically my answer would be something more along the lines of coffee. I'm a big coffee fan. So I would go in that direction. Anytime I speak about alcohol, it would be me just trying to scratch and claw for something to say there. I do like mezcal a lot, and I enjoy bourbon. But I'm no alcohol connoisseur at all. If I try to show any depth of knowledge, then you'll quickly realize that I'm not really super into it. So
I'm probably a little too proficient in the arts of alcohol.
Yeah. I'm more proficient in eating, but curious to hear on your front what you've been eating recently.
Yeah. I love to eat. But when I was thinking about this, the one thing I'm into lately, and speaking of being a novice in something, I'm a novice in this, but dark chocolate is something that I've been kind of sampling. And if anybody out there who's listening has some good suggestions about good dark chocolate, 75, 80, 85% cocoa, you know, like, I'm interested. I'll just travel around when I'm on the road. If I see an interesting dark chocolate bar, I'll take it and nibble on it. And I've been reading that it's kind of healthy for you in small doses. So that, I think that's what kind of turned me on to it. So that kind of came to mind. Any food, I'm also in a little bit of a, I don't want to say it's not really a health kick, but I'm just more and more conscious of trying to eat pure foods, things that aren't processed, things that don't, that, you know, like have very few ingredients in them. And I have some kids who are, you know, they're 13, 14 year old, and the stuff that they eat is really bothers me. You know, I look at majority of the food that they eat, and you look at the ingredients label and there's, you know, 35 things on it, and it can't be good for them. So I'm trying to like get them to eat like more pure foods and more wholesome in a way, more healthy. Not that they don't eat unhealthy, but even just like the bread that they have their sandwiches on, if you look at the all the ingredients in there that they have to inject to keep a loaf of bread fresh for a week, it's kind of frightening. So just trying to minimize the chemicals and things that we put in. And I think dark chocolate is a good example of something that's, you know, pretty essential. There's not a lot of ingredients in it. It's a pretty pure form of nature.
Absolutely. And it's a great example of something that I think when you get on that kind of kick that you're talking about, a little bit of a health kick or just trying to eat cleaner ingredients, dark chocolate's a great example of something that pretty darn tasty, but also, you know, reasonably high quality and something that's pretty good for you if you manage your intake. Is a dark chocolate bar every single day the healthiest choice? Potentially not. But, you know, probably along the same lines of like red wine. You know, people can easily say, oh, red wine's healthy. Like, I'll just have 3 glasses a night. I think that may or may not hold true, but, you know, a few glasses a week is probably a good thing.
Yeah. I'll get up, I'll snap, you know, the most bars kind of are segmented in those little rectangles.
Yeah.
So I'll snap off maybe 2 in the morning, right when I get up, and eat those right before the coffee. And that's good. That's my intake mostly.
Nice. What about reading? Anything interesting you've been reading recently?
I'm in a constant state of trying to catch up on all my New Yorkers. That pile never seems to go down. It only seems to increase. When I'm traveling, I'll take a bunch on the plane and try to knock a few out. So there's just a constant Sisyphean effort to try to narrow down that pile. It's always kind of depressing to me when I grab a bunch, I'll grab some off the bottom and I'll notice like what month they're from. And like, I think I'm, you know, I'm still trying to catch up on stuff from last September, you know, so that the New Yorker is a constant. I love it when I get an issue and I'm flipping through it and none of the articles are compelling, so I'll just discard that one. That's a quick way to knock one out. But also I've also gone back and started reading my favorite author. When I started really kind of getting into literature, when I was younger and entertained the idea of trying to be a fiction writer, Don DeLillo was the author that really turned me on. He was considered in the 80s and 90s one of the kind of the top literary voices in American fiction. And he's still alive and still writing, but that was kind of his sweet spot. His first book, though, is called Americana. He wrote it in the late 60s. And, you know, I don't think that many aficionados of DeLillo would say that was his finest work. But to me, there's something about it that I go back to it every maybe 5 years and reread it. The first third of the book, the first section is sort of like, it's about a guy who's an ad executive in New York. So it kind of has some of that Mad Men feel to it. He's a young guy kind of feeling his way around. And it also has like some early Office Space kind of humor to it. Some pointing out the absurdities of office life in a big ad factory television network situation, and there's a lot of a kind of arch comedy to it, but also some really exquisite writing and some wry observations about life and culture at that time. So it's just a favorite. It might be my favorite book, and I'm in the process of rereading it for maybe the fourth time now.
Nice. I think that's a great thing to do, to go back and reread books that you enjoy, whether, well, I was about to say, whether you gain something new or not, you always gain something new. It's like a movie. If you watch a movie 18 times, by the 18th time, if it's a good movie, you're still probably picking up something new. But I almost use that as a tool. Anytime I've gone a little bit stale, I love to read. But if I've read a couple books that just aren't quite as interesting to me, I'll use that as a platform to say, hey, I'm going to go back and read something that I really enjoy to kind of reignite that spark for reading. I think that it's a really great thing to do, not only to learn more about the book, but you know, just kind of reignite that passion.
So do you read books and novels and nonfiction?
Mostly nonfiction. I need to read more novels. I've certainly read plenty over time, but over the last couple of years, that's not been the direction I've gone. This is nothing new for me, but recently I've been on a big kind of autobiography kick, or just biographies in general. I love reading about just one person in particular. I think that you can, you know, really pick up a lot of interesting stuff there. Been reading John Feinstein's recent book on David Faraday recently. And that one's been interesting. I mean, he has people see Faraday as this kind of comedic figure, which he is. But those that know a little bit more about him know that his life has been really complicated, and there's a lot of depth to it. And I've not gotten quite to the part yet where I think that they'll probably go into kind of what's happened with Liv and what that potentially means for his future. But it's been interesting learning more about Faraday and his kind of challenged and pretty rocky background. But that's the kind of book that in a general sense, I probably gravitate towards.
Yeah, I ask because, and I think that that's interesting, and I'm glad to hear that. I keep hearing that young people, and I don't know how old you are, but don't read as much anymore. And it makes sense because we're so into screens, or what we're reading is not in the form of a book. Maybe that's the better way to put it. And I notice it in my kids. You know, they have, my son is about to turn 13, and he has zero interest in books. No matter how hard we try, you know, we try to get him any kind of books, and he just is just not going to read. He's going to grow up not reading books, and I don't know that he's going to be worse for the wear of it, because I don't know that his peers or other 12-year-old boys or girls are reading that much either. It's just the kind of a changeover in the generations and how we take in information. But you know, reading was just a part of my upbringing and probably yours too. But I mean, during the summers, I'd knock out 7, 8, 9 books, you know, cause you're bored as you just have a stack of books that I was going to read that summer. And that's just not the way it is anymore. They're just into their screens, and they just, the intake of information is different. And as somebody who's in media, I don't know what to think about that. I have to assume it's going to be okay, but it kind of hits me at the core to think that books may no longer have a much of a purpose in this world, you know, especially like projecting out into 20, 30 years into the future.
Yeah. You're preaching to the choir with that one. I love to read, but I'm concerned that younger people may or may not really be that into it. And in the future, that may not be the case. It's part of why we do the dirt on this podcast and include reading as one of those tenets is getting people to think about what they've been reading. And also those that listen say, you know, hey, like other people are reading out there, and it's a really, really great way to spend time. I love sitting down with a good book and just spending some time. Let's move on to thinking. Anything in particular intentionally ambiguous that's been on your mind?
Well, from a practical standpoint, work-wise, what's on my mind and I've been thinking a lot about is Augusta National and Valhalla, the first two majors. So we're doing a lot of preparation for this season and those two tournaments coming up, the Masters and the PGA Championship. So I've been spending a lot of time doing dives on the architecture of both of those courses. But in a more philosophical sense, when you just mentioned the word, and it has to do with kind of reading too, is time. I've been spending a lot of time thinking about the concept of time and how we use time and my time and how there's not enough of it and how it, you know, you can't ever wrap your arms around it There's not enough time in my life for me to read all the things that I want to read. You know, I mentioned the New Yorkers, and it's so hard. I remember a times in my life when I had the somehow ability to, you know, take an hour off in the middle of the day and go lay on the couch with a book and read it. You know, had times at night where I turn the TV off and just read for a couple hours. And now it just seems everything goes by so fast and it's so fleeting. And when you have children and you see them grow up and all the things that they're involved in, and it's a constant juggling and of time and space and management, and it's a little frustrating to feel so out of control with all the things that we have to do. And I know, I mean, you know, that's life. Many people feel the same way. But I had a dream the other night, and all of these things were going on, and there was chaos, and people were arguing, and there were things to do. And somehow in my dream, like, I stepped into this other room, and there was like this tin pail on a shelf, and I picked up the pail and I walked outside in my dream into a garden. And I was able to do, I don't garden, but in my dream, I was like picking vegetables and, you know, putting, you know, just kind of slowly walking around. And it was so peaceful, and it just felt like that is something that we, you know, I wish it was telling me something that I needed to spend more time doing, like, nothing if possible. And it's just in my dream, like, I found this moment of peace in a garden. So that's been on my mind, and I've been thinking a little bit more about that. And I'm sure that's not going to stop as I continue to age.
Is there anything in particular you've been making more time for recently?
No, I mean, I think that's the problem, is there's no more time to be made.
It's, yeah, per the thinking.
It's all spoken for.
Yeah. No, I'm 26. I have a very full-time job. I like to do this. I like to do a lot of things. So I also can relate there on feeling like, you know, so many days go by where it's like, oh, well, I woke up at 5 and here we are, it's 9:50, and I've been doing something for basically every minute of the day. And, you know, you do 6-7 of those in a row, and you're not having a lot of extra time. So, I can completely understand
and,
that.
And at least for me, it's like, oh, I've been sitting here for a couple hours, and, you know, I've been working and getting things done, but it's not where I thought I was going to be. You know, I still don't feel like I'm behind schedule already. And that's a feeling almost every day.
Yeah. Understood. okay. Well, let's go back in time here and kind of set the table, for our golf conversation. I'd love to hear just your background in the game, frankly, how you got into it. And I guess in particular, how that developed into such a deep passion for golf course architecture. And, you know, that'll kind of put us in a good spot to start talking about your career with Golf Digest and what you do these days and all of your passions there.
Yeah. I mean, I bet my introduction to golf was very similar to most people who are going to be listening to this podcast. My dad played golf, and I just remember being as a kid, you know, seeing his clubs and his, these funny shoes with a flap on top and these metal spikes on the bottom, and wondering, you know, seeing his golf bag in the garage and wondering, like, what all of these different instruments did, and unzipping the pockets and seeing golf balls and tees and a little scrubber for the clean the clubs. And there's all the accoutrements that go with golf that are kind of like, if you think about them in one way, they're kind of absurd. And as a, I don't know, you know, 8-year-old, they're especially absurd and fascinating at the same time. So that just always intrigued me. Like, where does he go and what does he do with all of this stuff? And then as I got older, I the picture became a little more clear, and I started to play golf, and I was always kind of fascinated by the ritualistic elements of it. But then I remember what I became most interested in were golf courses at a very early age. When we'd go to the class in, you know, elementary school, to the library, like, I would go to the sports section, see if I could find books about golf courses, like with pictures, big color pictures. And I've said this before, like on my podcast, that's what really hooked me is looking. I grew up in Colorado, so all the golf courses were kind of like open and treeless. And I would see a picture of like La Quinta, you know, with this golf course near a reflection pond and some palm trees and a mountain in the background, or these courses in Florida with palm trees and sand and water everywhere. And that just looked like the coolest thing to me. And I was so interested in that. And that always stayed with me. That was my hook for golf. I, you know, was a respectable player, but never skilled. But I just always wanted to go see different golf courses and get on the road. And that stayed with me. And I made a move in 2000. My fiance and I moved to Florida, where she was from Colorado. And I needed a new job. And she came home one day with an ad from, she was in law school at the University of Florida. She came home from with the school paper, and there was a little, literally like a classified ad that said, you know, do you like to play golf? Do you want to write about golf courses? And it was a new, it was a website called travelgolf.com that was opening, like a Florida Golf Florida or floridagolf.com. I forget which. So I replied to it. I said, yeah, I'd like, what can I do? And they said, well, go play some golf courses, do some writing, send it into us. And if it's good, we'll publish it and pay you. And they paid, I think, $25 a story. You know, they could budget me like $100 a month is all they could afford at the time. But I spent a few years in Florida doing that, just driving around, playing golf courses, writing these reviews for this online company. And it just kind of, my writing and golf career kind of just bloomed from that. I gradually met some people and got some contacts at magazines. I remember my first print magazine story was a huge deal. This was probably like in 2002 or 2003, as Lynx Magazine hired me to go to Lake Oconee in Georgia and write about the golf scene there. And it was like such a thrill to see your name in a magazine with pictures on it and go through that whole process. And I've been doing it off and on ever since. That was my start. That was my hook, golf courses. And then just along the way, you know, studying architecture and learning the names, learning the history. What is attractive and stimulating about it is the courses and the history and the architecture.
And so have you been working in golf as a writer full time your entire career, or was there a point at which you were doing it on the side alongside something else?
Since never full time, really. I mean, it was always freelance. It was always independent work. So there would be busy periods and fallow periods. And fortunately, I had a situation where I wasn't the primary breadwinner in our family. My wife was an attorney, and she's been very supportive of me. And there have certainly been times when she said, "When are you going to make this work? When are you going to turn this into something better?" But it was just kind of doing everything that I do now independently and working with different magazines and different outlets. And when I started my podcast in 2017, Feed the Ball, that kind of was I'd fallen out of the thing for a while. I'd doing other writing for non-golf writing and wasn't very happy with it. And raising our two kids, I was stay at home. And so I'd been taking them to school and driving them around and being basically a house husband, and had kind of gotten away from golf. And then I just felt like I needed to give it one more chance. So I started the podcast, which is architectural themed. I still had some contacts, architects that I knew who I called up and asked if they'd come on. Jim Eng was my first guest. I'd known him for a while. Such an interesting character. And some other people that kind of got it off the ground. And that really kind of rekindled my spark and my interest in being in the golf profession and golf journalism, golf writing. So I give the podcasting a lot of credit for keeping me in it. And that's really what put me in touch with the people at Golf Digest, where I work now. So they hired me in the beginning of 2020 to be at that time, the associate architect editor. The architecture editor for Golf Digest, Ron Witten, who's an absolute legend in this field, started working for them in 1985. And he'd had that job the entire time since and really created the profession. I mean, he was doing that before anybody else was. They were the first magazine that really devoted full-time space and full-time editorship to architecture. And he was a guest on my podcast at one point. I had him on. We had a good talk and didn't really connect much after that. But then, sometime around the summer of 2019, he calls me up and he asked me if I'd be interested. He said he was going to be stepping down, in the next couple of years, and wanted to know if I'd have any interest in pursuing his job. And I was like, what? Like, I didn't even know that was an option. I mean, it was beyond my even my comprehension that that was available. But anyway, long and short, they hired me, and it was because I had Ron on my podcast that he even knew who I was. I don't think he would have known me otherwise. And then he kind of took an early exit during COVID, and he's actually, Ron, I have to take a minute to talk about Ron. He's doing very well right now. He's actually very active in designing, and he's working with some other architects as consultants. So he's got a lot of renovation projects going on. He lives in Kansas City. He's doing well. He was sort of like the modern Paul Bunyan of golf course architecture knowledge. In the 1970s, when nobody else was doing this, he was an attorney, a prosecutor, and he, in his spare time, he was doing research projects about golf course architecture and digging up histories. And this is, you know, before the internet. This is before there's any access to information. He's going to libraries and looking on microfiche, trying to dig up the backstories on Perry Maxwell or you know, Tillinghast, or even architects that we wouldn't even be talking about today, just obscure people, calling up relatives, asking if they had any material that their grandfather had left over in the attic, just compiling this incredible database of physical information about these people. And all of that turned into the book that he wrote with Jeffrey Cornish called, first it was called The Golf Course, and then it, the second edition that came out in the 90s was called The Architects of Golf. It's still the best resource for looking up any information about architects and what courses they designed and some of their biographies. And I mean, he was just doing that on his own as a pastime before Jerry Tardy at Golf Digest met him and eventually convinced Ron to retire from being an attorney and come to work for Golf Digest full time. So Ron was there first and did it, and still arguably did it better than anybody else. So I owe him a huge debt of gratitude for inviting me and giving me the opportunity to pick up where he left off.
Yeah, no, that's great. That covered the first, you know, 15 minutes of what I wanted to ask you about, of career and how you got into Golf Digest. That was awesome. So we covered a lot of ground. Good. There. I want to then, you know, use that as a platform to move into, tell me about how you initially got involved with the whole rating system at Golf Digest. You know, how you kind of took the reins there from Ron Whitten, and what your career has, or your past handful of years have been like, you know, getting into the ratings and some of the developments that you've implemented with the whole system.
Yeah. When I envisioned working for Golf Digest and working with Ron at first and eventually being the architecture editor, I envisioned, you know, writing stories, talking, you know, covering the field, as Ron would say, you know, talking to architects, doing major championship previews, just doing editorial things, which we do that, and that is part of the job. What I wasn't prepared for was managing our course ranking panel and the rankings, which is almost a full-time job in and of itself. Or it needs to be, really. And I manage the panel with Steve Hennessy, who's the deputy managing editor at Golf Digest, and invaluable. I couldn't do it without Steve's help, for sure. We have 1,700-1,800 course ranking panelists. They're not all active. Many of them don't do very many reviews. But we have a good core of I would say 600-700 panelists that are active, and they're out around the country compiling course evaluations for us and just kind of overseeing them and giving them the resources they need and organizing things throughout the years is the part of the job that I didn't have any awareness of. And it's taken me a long time to wrap my arms around it and to kind of figure out what I think the panel needs and the direction it needs to go. So we've made some choices and some management changes. I guess you could say they're changes or just modifications. And really what I've spent the last couple of years doing is, the first thing was the concern that I had, number one, was whether or not our panel as a whole were on the same page with their architectural knowledge, with their ability to judge the categories that we have in the most effective way. The Golf Digest grew the panel significantly from around 2015 through right before I got there. It probably increased in size maybe threefold. So all of these new people were coming on, and I just wasn't sure that they had gotten the training that they needed. One reason is because the technology just wasn't there. There was no way to get, you know, a couple hundred new people together and really go over the ins and outs of our criteria and how we evaluate courses. I was given the resources to put together a training program, which I spent about a year working on. And now it's about 10 hours worth of training, online training, that every new panelist we bring on has to go through. And now all of our veteran panelists are going back and going through it as well. It's mandatory, but it's pretty comprehensive. It's like 2.5 hours of the history of golf architecture in America, which I made. It's kind of like a Ken Burns like documentary journey through the history of architecture, and with the theme being how tastes in architecture always change and what motivates the change. Listeners, you know, it's a little bit like Keith Cutton, an architect who works with Dave Axland and Rod Whitman, wrote a book a few years ago called The Evolution of Golf Course Design. And it's a bit like that in video format. And then there's a section with architect interviews where they can get a sense of what architects are thinking when they design, and architects talking about our different categories and how they perceive it. And then the last section is all about how we do the scoring, what our category definitions are. And there's videos where we go through a mock evaluation of Pebble Beach of different with a veteran panelist talking about Pebble Beach in shot options, or Pebble Beach, how they would look at it in layout variety. So these are I think they're very useful training modules that all of our panelists will go through now. And if nothing else, it gives me the comfort to know that at least they've been exposed to our standards and exposed to a certain degree of historical information and knowledge about architects and architecture if they didn't have it before. And they always have that to fall back onto if they you know, ever need a refresher. So that's been one of the things that I think I hope is will improve us overall as a panel, is just to kind of get everybody on the same page and understand what the scoring criteria is, what they should be looking for in these categories, in a little bit more deeper way than they had access to before. And that's just all through the ability to present this in a place online where they can go and access this, which really probably in the 10 years ago, I don't know if Golf Digest really had the resources to devote to that kind of level of training.
So is it safe to say that a lot of your focus has been, rather than around changing the system in some large way, it's been more so on the personnel front, not necessarily changing the personnel, but just making sure that the people who are already there are best informed to be able to go out and actually evaluate courses properly, as opposed to saying, hey, this is the way that you need to really change the way you're thinking about this?
I would say that's true, yeah. I just wanted to make sure that I had confidence that everybody who's out there and representing Golf Digest and submitting evaluations has a same basis of knowledge, and that the numbers that they write down, and we can get into like our scoring system, I'm happy to, is that they're using the same metrics and the same scoring gauge. And in the past, it was kind of vague how they could write down their numbers in each category. It's always been 1 through 10, but one panelist could go and look at, you know, say St. Louis Country Club and write down, look at the architecture and say, wow, this is really, really, really fantastic. I like it. And they'll write down, you know, an 8.2. Another panelist could go look at the same course and feel the exact same thing. This is really, really outstanding architecture, and write down a 6.9. It just, the system had, it didn't have any standard way of standardizing what numbers people wrote down based on their own impression, which we want them all to have their own impression. That's why we have them. But I wanted them to start thinking along the lines of, well, St. Louis Country Club's shot options are, you know, I think top 30 in the country. So now it's it, now they have, they know, well, if it's top 30, then that equates to like an 8.1. So if the other panelists said, who was going to give it a 6.9 before, has, now they're thinking, well, but it, I do think it's top 30 in the country. So instead of writing down a 6.9, now they know that they need to adjust that score up. So it just, it standardizes the impressions that people have of what numbers they should be writing down. So you just don't have, it's not as impressionistic in a way. So I wanted, and that was the main goal. Since I've been there, we're not trying to engineer any kind of results. It's really just about making sure that panelists have access to the same information that they know, that what number they know the value of the number that they're writing down in each category. Whereas before it was just, like I said, it was amorphous, you know, they were defined by, like, you know, this is very, you know, very good, very good, excellent, most, I mean, these words that didn't tie back into any tier in the ranking before. So that's what we've done, is tied back the numbers to like specific tiers in the ranking. And I wanted to try to get them to think in terms of where would this course rank in this category? You know, if it's a average course down the street, well, would this be like guessing the 500th best course in challenge in that panelist estimation? If it was in that category, then yeah, then the number to write down is something in like 6.1 to 6.4 or something like that. So that's the idea of the changes. But the categories that Golf Digest have had tie back over 50 years. So, I mean, there's a lot of institutional legitimacy in the categories. They've changed names, and the definitions have changed over the years in reaction to the way the game has changed and points of emphasis. But, you know, we can't go back and you know, mess that up. There's too much value and history behind Golf Digest rankings. So, you know, there's an honor that we have to preserve in those categories, and that idea that our magazine, our publication, our entity builds evaluations over these in these different categories. So we want to preserve that continuity, but it's just about making sure that we have the right systems of knowledge to be able to effectively build an evaluation that's going to add value.
And now a quick word from our friends at Good Walk Coffee.
Dude, I've been getting a lot of questions recently about the magical fruit.
Big blueberry?
Nope, I'm talking beans here. Coffee beans.
What do people want to know?
Where to get a steal on quality beans shipped to their doorstep. Do you have anything?
Absolutely. A company called Good Walk Coffee, based in California, roasted in North Carolina. Great beans, nice people, excellent variety.
Are they a steal though? People want value.
Oh, I got the steal for you. Use code THETIE, that is THETIE, at checkout for 20% off any order.
So that puts us around $1 per day for 2 cups of quality coffee. That's below market price for quality beans. Where can I send them?
That's exactly right. Send them to goodwalkcoffee.com. Tell them the Tie Guy sent you. Once again, that is code THETIE, THETIE, 20% off any order at goodwalkcoffee.com.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, I'm interested to hear, based on that, not, you know, not changing things too significantly over time with kind of the reverence to history, do you think at all about how maybe that pertains when we actually get to, okay, so how does this pertain to the rankings that we end up coming up with, how that pertains to the way that maybe architectural preferences change over time and just kind of the ongoing development of golf courses and, you know, the ability for a new course to really break its way into the rankings, the way for potentially an older course that maybe has fallen a bit out of favor, how it, you know, just from a statistical standpoint might be held up too long in the rankings. Do you think about that and how those categories end up pertaining to the actual rankings that you come up with?
Yeah, I do. And you're on Golf's panel, right?
Golf.com, correct.
Yeah. So what I find interesting about about this conversation is that the two publications go about it in completely different ways. Like I know golf, you don't have any kind of categories or standards. I mean, it's much more impressionistic. They ask, you're asked to, as far as I understand, to kind of rate courses into blocks or tiers. You know, is this course worthy of being a top 10 to 20 course and so forth. And ours is based more on volume and data. So we have standards about how many evaluations a course has to have before it qualifies for being a best in state candidate. Right now they have to have a minimum of 25 ballots or evaluations turned in over a 10-year period to be eligible to be on a best in state list. And for them to be on the 100 greatest list or second 100 greatest list, they have to have at least 50 evaluations taken over a 10-year period. And then we're grading also in these six different categories now. So with that knowledge, it does change how I think about the way we process the rankings a little bit. And if I'm not mistaken, golf, basically every 2 years, you start fresh. There's no holdover from the previous ranking. So that gives Golf Magazine the ability for, I think that gives the ability for like a new course to come in pretty hot or a renovated course to come in pretty hot. You can react maybe a little quicker in real time based on changing situations. You know, if a course undergoes a significant restoration, it can make a huge jump. We have that ability a little bit, so I'm conscious of that with the volume of evaluations that courses have to have. That has the potential to slow reaction times down. I dropped the and when I by the way when I say I mean these are decisions that we make in groups, but I moved to drop our 100 greatest evaluation number from 75 down to 50. Because I wanted our rankings to be a little more in real time than they had been. We collect the data, as I said, over 10 years. So there was a lot of potential drag on certain courses. You know, if they had really high or low numbers 10 years ago, how much of an impact does that matter now? I mean, that was a decade ago. Has the course gotten better? Has it matured? Has it evolved? So another thing that I propose that we're doing now is we value recent evaluations more strongly than older evaluations. So an evaluation that came in 2015 will only have like 0.1 something impact on the course's overall score. And then the rankings from 2016 will have like 0.19, you know, like, and it's on a curve. So but I also think that what that does is values newer evaluations over older. So that means that courses that have gotten better, that they'll show up in the rankings a little bit quicker than they would have in the past. So these are things that I think about in just trying to get our rankings a little more flexible. To thinking about new courses, that's never been a problem. That's always been one of the big criticisms about Golf Digest rankings is that a new course would open up and it's the hot new thing and our panelists go there and the accusation is that they overvalue it because it's new and bright and shiny. And then that some new course will pop up at number, 18 or 25 in the rankings. And then it inevitably over time, it just sort of melts away and goes down and slides off. And there's probably a lot of validity to that because that's happened over and over and over again. You can look at our rankings and see, well, this course topped out. This so-and-so course came in hot at, number debuted at 41 and now it's ranked 167th. You know, what happened? So there was probably a little overvaluing in that. And that goes to education, I think, too, and giving people, giving our panelists a wider perspective on architecture. Talking about it and saying, look, times change. We have to take the big picture. You know, just because it's new doesn't mean it's the best. You know, it's and I think we'll see a lot less of that now with these hot new courses flashing. I think our minimum standard requirement helps with that too. Like it took a Hoopy Match Club a couple cycles for it to finally debut in 2023-24 ranking. It finally was listed, but it didn't have the evaluation numbers to get on it before that. Cap Rock Ranch is another one to kind of keep with Gil Hance's, you know, that it hadn't gotten up to 50 yet when we released our last rankings. And Golf Magazine had it at pretty high in the like 50 something or 40 something. So all those things go into the mix when I think about how we could streamline or make our rankings more efficient.
So kind of from a statistical integrity standpoint, we've talked a lot about, you know, the minimum barrier for a course to be able to be rated. Is there a top end as well, such that, you know, let's say a course that's been rated for 50 years has all of these ratings. Is there a cap at which it's the most recent X number of ratings, if that makes sense, so that a course doesn't have, you know, 10,000 ratings where all of a sudden, even if someone gave it a 0 out of 100, just as a random example, it wouldn't actually move anything, if that makes sense.
That is the case in many instances. There are courses that have hundreds of active evaluations going back 10 years. It's very hard to move that number. When you get up to a certain number, a certain volume, yeah, you could get 10 new ranking or, you know, evaluations that are all better than what's in the system already or worse than what's in the system. And it's not going to move that overall number at all. So, but that's, you know, that's up to the clubs if they want to keep hosting panelists. And I would say some clubs around the country are pretty on top of it and kind of know where they stand and you know, are aware of their scores and their evaluation numbers. And there are clubs that aren't actively engaged in the process. So that's what I think is different about Golf Digest is that it, you know, our rankings are data driven. It's a consensus of a broad, as many panelists as possible, what they think of a course. And we were able to take that average, you know, we clip out at the outlier scores if anything's a little too high or a little too low, that's, you know, some emotional scores, we take those out. But it's a consensus of a wide range of panelists and viewpoints on architecture, but all within the given system. It is interesting that our top 20 courses don't move that much. You know, a course may slide up or down one or two spots, but I think the last course to break into the top 20 and stay there was Friar's Head, and that was, what, 2005? 20 to 30, there's a little bit of play in there, but it's really, really hard to get into that top echelon. And once you get there, once courses get there, it's also typically hard with their evaluation numbers to dislodge them. But we could get into the which courses those are. But there's a reason they're there. It's because there's a wide range of people, a huge volume of people who all basically think the same thing about that golf course.
Yeah, no, I've always wondered that, and that makes sense. I think for certain courses, it's probably a positive thing for them to kind of have that bedrock and not have someone come in and be able to have a bad day and potentially, you know, rock the boat too much. But yeah, it's an interesting thing to think about. I'm pretty statistically driven person, and just kind of the numbers behind it, I've always wondered kind of how that works. And as you put it, a data driven system. This is a little bit of a different question, but you know, you've talked a lot about your raters and the size of the list, and something that I've always thought is frankly really positive about the Golf Digest system is the fact that a lot of different types of people can be on your panel, and they, you know, they pay a number to be on it, and it gives access to people to play courses that they may really struggle to gain access to. Is that something that you ever think about necessarily? The fact that, you know, this random guy who lives in South Dakota may have the opportunity to go play a large number of the top 100 golf courses in the country that otherwise they might not get the chance to?
No, I don't really think about that. I think I'm so concerned. I mean, we don't look, I guess I, you know, that's great. That's a great perk, right? To be able to go and play places that you couldn't play. But I see a lot of applications that say, you know, oh, I'd really love the chance to go out and play all these private courses that I can't play. I'm just like, well, that's not a good reason. You know, that's not a compelling argument for why we should take you on the panel. Everybody wants to do that. We don't need any more panelists. I mean, we've got enough. I'm concerned about getting panelists to, if that guy's, by the way, if anybody is in South Dakota and wants to be a golf digest panelist, I might be able to use you because we struggle to get people to go there. I'm concerned with finding people that can represent us in parts of the country that are underserved, where we have, you know, states like New Mexico or Arkansas, New Hampshire. We struggle to get people to get those states covered to the number, you know, since we have these thresholds that need to be met before courses can get on. So I'm looking for people from those places. But more than anything, like what motivates me when I look at our panel is I want people who have an incredible wealth of knowledge about golf and architecture and the history of the game, and they know what they're looking at, and they care about it, and have some exposure to great golf. That the person that hasn't seen a lot of great golf courses, it's very hard for them to become a good panelist because the learning curve is so much steeper just because they don't have the comparisons. You know, they're going to go see, you know, so I don't know, just a, you know, Torrey Pines South, right? And that's going to be the best golf course that they've ever played. So the tendency is that they're going to give that scores that are not indicative of what they would be in 5 years after they've seen 50 other courses that are better than Torrey Pines. You know what I mean? So that it's more important for Steve and I to find people that have a lot of experience playing at, and I'm talking about at this point, you know, because we want to be very selective, who have a lot of experience and have a lot of architectural knowledge. We don't have to train them up. It's a good story to be able to bring somebody on who doesn't have a lot of experience playing around the country, and then now they get to do it. But that's certainly not a point of emphasis for us.
I have a lot of respect for the answer. I work in finance, and the answer reminds me of someone just sticking to their fiduciary duty. It's about creating value for the investors, not making money for yourself. So agreed that, you know, it's a good thing, but I love the fact that you're focused on, you know, the ultimate rankings that you produce as opposed to what maybe the perks are for people that get to be a part of creating them. Yeah. So I want to ask about you specifically and, you know, kind of how you think about golf courses and also how this has become such a big part of your life. I guess at the current moment and then also just over the last, you know, number of years, how big a piece of your life has traveling to see different golf courses become? And then in what context do you like to do that? Do you like to travel with friends? Do you really enjoy going and seeing different courses on your own? How do you like to experience actually living out this process of rating golf courses and learning more about golf course architecture?
Mm. First of all, I will just say this. I actually don't do any evaluations on my own. So it's just my, you know, I'm overseeing the panel, but I never fill out a ballot or a scorecard, just to make that clear. Cause a lot of times that I get asked that question, or that's the assumption when I'm contacting clubs. But I'm glad you asked that, because I live in this kind of weird thing, and maybe it's just me, my life, my personality, but I'll go to Bandon Dunes or Sand Valley, and I'm there usually for a reason. And I see the people that go there, and it's, you know what it's like. It's guys mostly traveling in groups. It could be two, could be three, could be eight. And they're away. This is their thing. They're having the great time. They're playing golf. They have their games. They're getting a little boisterous. Then now they're eating and drinking at night. and I'm there by myself every time. And I'm just solo. I'm mixed in with the foursome, or a threesome, or a twosome. I'm the odd guy out. I'm eating by myself at night. You know, maybe I have a contact at the resort. So that's how I travel. And I've never gone on a buddy's trip to these places. It's just the nature of what I do is I'm out there alone. And I might go to some city and meet up with somebody that I know, and have dinner with them. But for the most part, I'm showing up at clubs on my own and playing, usually with, you know, the head pro or the director of golf or their club champion or somebody who they want to pair me with. And I'm there for a reason. Sometimes it's if the club's going to host a major the next year, like I was in Valhalla last fall to get ready for our packages that we'll be producing now. You know, I'll look at the venues that I have to see for majors next year and try to hit them this year, this summer. Best new courses, those candidates, I'll try to go see all of those. You know, renovation candidates, I'll try to see all of those. If there's a story we're doing about a course or an architect, I'll go. So I'm there on business, and I'll call the course and tell them why, and everybody's very gracious and usually is happy to host me. But you know, it's not a pleasure trip. I'm not there with friends. It's kind of on point the whole time and paying attention and taking notes. And so the way that I just find that interesting and a little paradoxical, that, you know, the things that I do in my job, and I'm not the only one, other people who have work in golf media are like this too, but we're experiencing the same things that others are, but our job is not to enjoy them. it's to tell stories about them and to explain them so that other people can go to Bandon Dunes and Sand Valley and these other places and with their friends and have a good time. And I'm not to say that, I don't mean that to sound anything but grateful and happy, because I love it and I do get enjoyment out of it. I do learn a lot. My favorite thing to do is to get up early and go to a golf course at you know 6:30 with the grounds crew, you know, 30 minutes before the first groups go out, and just walk the course, take my time, take pictures, make notes, study the architecture. I do that all the time, and that's where I get a real enjoyment. That's peaceful for me. That's my happy place. But it is a little ironic to me that I work in this profession and I don't, you know, I haven't enjoyed the golf travel aspect of it the way that so many other people do. And that what kind of floats this industry is traveling with friends.
I totally understand what you're saying. You'll probably instill a lot of envy in people out of that answer, that, you know, the quote that golf travel no longer is pleasure for you. But I understand what you're saying, that you very much enjoy it, but it's not a purely pleasure driven trip. It's to, you know, see something and, you know, help other people understand how they can, you know, go enjoy a different course and create value for those courses around that. I'm interested to hear if there's a round in particular that you recall, maybe in your younger years, or it could be recently, that was, you know, particularly formative for you. Is there a golf course or maybe a few golf courses that you recall that really kind of instilled something in you about how interesting golf course architecture is?
I always joke that I never played a good golf course until I was 30 years old. growing up in where I grew up, there weren't that many what we'd consider like really interesting or good golf courses. You know, there's some good golf courses in Denver, but I never had access to Cherry Hills or Castle Pines at that time. That's good. You know, I think the first one that really kind of maybe switched me on was when I live in the Atlanta area and moved here in 2003. And I went over out to, actually this would have been on that assignment that I mentioned earlier for Links Magazine when I wrote about Lake Oconee, and I played Cuscawilla, which was an early core and Crenshaw golf course. And seeing that was so different to me. I'd played the other Lake Oconee, it used to be called Reynolds Plantation. Now it's called Reynolds Lake Oconee, and they have a Fazio course, a Nicholas course, a Bob Cup course, a Reese Jones course, and they're really nice. They're all kind of cut out of the same cloth. And then you go to Cuscoilla, and it's just so different. It's broad, it's spacious. There's width. This bunkering looks like, you know, like some predator gouged it out of the earth with these, you know, rugged, you know, fescue-y fingers. The greens are like kind of crown and slick, you know, and it's just, there's only two holes on the water, whereas every other resort's doing their best to try to get as many holes on the lake as they can. So, and that was probably the one eye opener. And I knew about Coore and Crenshaw, and I had, you know, was on Golf Club Atlas, and, you know, was at that time, and was that was a huge learning opportunity for me to be in those forums and to read. So I was aware of minimalism, quote unquote, and what was going on, but to see it firsthand was an eye opener. And I remember after that, I called Bill Coore. That was the first time I talked to Bill, and we had a conversation, and he was so unbelievably gracious to me and willing to talk about Cuscoilla. And he still is. If you ever get a chance to talk to Bill, I don't know if you've ever had a conversation with him. I mean, he's as genuine a person as you can get, and he has time for everybody, and he's so giving. And he was like that then, and just some kid calling him up out of the blue, talking to him about Cuscoilla, and he would just walk me through it as calm as could be. And that whole experience made a huge impression on me. I would say Cuscoilla.
That's a fascinating answer, but one I have a lot of appreciation for. I actually, my cousins have a place there, and so I was there over Thanksgiving this past year, and somewhat similar reaction. Like, didn't really know anything about the golf course, and looked into it a few days prior. I was like, oh wow, it's like Coore and Crenshaw. That's probably going to be pretty interesting. And yeah, just like not the most special piece of property ever, but it shows that minimalism goes really, really far when you do have great land. And I think Coore and Crenshaw have shown that with some of their best designs. But just because you don't have 10 out of 10 land doesn't mean that you all of a sudden have to have this massive amount of human intervention to make an interesting golf course. You know, if you just have pretty decent land and you allow it to be as good as it can be, it can still be, you know, something super interesting. So that's a really interesting answer.
Yeah. And it goes to that down to routing the golf course. You know, you can have the good land, but you have to find the right spots on that land and use it correctly. The first six holes at Cuscoilla, I think, are still maybe like as good as any starting six holes you'll find. It just pulls you in and you're just locked in for the rest of the round.
Totally. Okay, Derek, I want to ask you one more question today. You've been very generous with your time. But I want to ask, as someone who's played so many courses and been thinking about this and doing this for such a long time, what is it in 2024, not necessarily a specific golf course, but maybe a theme or something that you're thinking about within golf course architecture that really fires you up, that's somewhat newer these days?
You know, I don't. That's a good question. I wish I had more time to think about it. You know, we started talking initially about Cabot Citrus Farms. You and I were, and I'm wondering, and I'm not the first person to pursue this line of thought, but I'm wondering how, if the concept of just making just big golf courses has had its time, has had its run. Modern architecture over the last 15 years is really defined at the highest end by scale. You know, you think of the golf courses that people are traveling to play and that get a lot of the press, and many have done really well in rankings, your rankings and our rankings as well. And they're all big. They're just big golf courses. And I know Tom Doak is aware of this in at Sedge Valley, which will open at Sand Valley this summer. You know, he's trying to reverse scale, but even that golf course has quite a bit of openness and width to it, even though it's not particularly long. I'm just wondering if there's a place for, you know, a modern day, you know, winged foot or something like that. You know, it's a long golf course, but more scaled down, you know, just not just so overblown. Are there pieces of property that can be utilized like that where, you know, the properties that architects get now, the new properties are all amazing, but they demand just spaciousness. They demand big holds. They demand, you know, certain size greens, just because they're so naturally endowed, and many of them are sandy and many of them are in windy places, and most of them don't have any kind of infringement around the edges that would force them to be small. You know, there you can just go out and build a golf course wherever you want. There's a half dozen, if not more, courses right now that are in construction or in planning that are in the same kind of like Sand Hills Uhupi model, where it's going to be a private national membership, guys who fly in for 2 nights. They'll have a cool lodging and an awesome little restaurant and bar, a fire pit to hang out with, and they'll play in these golf courses for you know, they'll play 4 rounds over 2 days or whatever. And they're all in these remote places. And so there's no limit to the expansiveness of the architecture. And I'm just trying to rack my brains and think like, well, what's an example recently of a golf course that was built in a smaller footprint that it has a little more, I don't want to use the word taste, but just a little more refinement, a little more elegance. Is there a space for that in architecture? How would that be consumed? How would that do, like, with this culture now of avid, well-to-do golfers who have the means to go travel around and become members at these clubs? That's what I'm thinking about. Can we retract? You know, the answer to that, the other side of the coin, is for size and dimension. You know, we have all these great little short courses that are built, and they're awesome, but it's not the same as having an 18-hole golf course that's on a smaller footprint. The one that I can think of now that I'm talking about it is Lost Rail outside of Omaha that opened last year. That's on 150 acres. So it is kind of and it doesn't have homes on it. It's just, that's enough room for a clubhouse, a driving range, the maintenance facilities, parking lot, and 18 holes. And so that would be an example of a golf course that is, you know, is maybe bucking the trend a little bit. That's interesting to me.
Yeah, I think that's a bit of a contrarian viewpoint, but one that I love. I have a good Australian friend who's in architecture, and we had a conversation kind of along these lines recently. And, you know, so many of the great courses in Melbourne and, you know, like Marion would be an example. You know, you're looking at a lot of courses that are in the 125 acre range that are able to get a clubhouse and a great golf course and a range as well. And I think that this potentially turns into a whole different conversation about real estate and certainly anything urban these days and in America. But I do think that that's something we're not necessarily thinking about and is fascinating. You used the term early in our conversation, nuclear, about a specific golf course. And that does feel like the kind of line of thinking that we're on right now. Don't get me wrong. I love sandy golf and I love great topography and these really big, interesting pieces of land, but everything feels like it's really nuclear right now. You know, we're really getting after it, and something smaller, more compact and more simplistic would be an absolute breath of fresh air. So love that answer.
Yeah, another one that I just came to mind was Kinsale down in Naples that Gil Hansen and Jim Wagner are building. I think that's on a pretty tight little parcel of land. In fact, the owner didn't have any intentions of building golf on it, but I don't think he could build the whatever other kind of real estate development that he wanted. So golf turned out to be the best answer, but they had to kind of keep everything tight and in there. And that's why they went with the Rainer model, because, you know, that's kind of an old school way of thinking. And there's a real art to routing a golf course on a tight piece of property. And I'm sure that many architects are capable of it, but they're just not asked to do it very much anymore. But that was part and parcel of golf in the 19 teens and 20s. You know, you'd have these smaller sections of land, and you've got to figure out ways to get holes in and out of corners and efficiently put 18 holes. And that's why we like old golf courses, because they are tight. They're so rhythmic, you know, they're so connected to each other, and it all feels part of the same entity. You know, you are in this one environment, and it's all relatable. And not to say that Sandhills isn't wonderful, but it's the opposite style of golf. You know, you're out and you're made aware of like how insignificant you are in this landscape. But I like the idea of being on a tight parcel of land where everything is harmonious and connected and flows and has rhythm to it. Like a song, like a nice tight song, like that is what we don't see enough in modern architecture, and for reasons that we've been talking about. But it'd be nice to see more examples of that come back.